This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. We continue our Beyond Binary series on underrepresented people in eastern North Carolina. House Bill 2 has brought matters that have been at the margins of the national collective consciousness, especially rural parts of a nation like eastern North Carolina, to the forefront, namely sexuality and gender identity. Chris Thomas spoke to local residents who find themselves outside of traditional socioeconomic demographics.
Sexuality and gender identity is getting confusing. New labels, definitions, and even pronouns seem to emerge daily. It's one of the drawbacks of nonconformity, and it's a point of empathy for Terry, who is pansexual and genderqueer. The singular they and them are their preferred pronouns, and they requested a pseudonym be used to identify them for this story.
I don't remember who said this, but you have to give your family twice as much time to come out as you gave yourself. And I didn't come out until I was 19 years old. So, you know, the confusion is valid.
Terry's sexuality and gender identity is something they gradually realized and came to terms with during their teen years and throughout their stint at East Carolina University. Terry remembers having feelings for members of the same sex as they reached adolescence, which was further complicated by the church they began attending, which had decidedly strong convictions.
The youth leaders were indoctrinating us for future indoctrination of other children. They did the whole righteous judges thing with us and told us that 9/11 was a punishment for the homosexuality in this country because of the military apologist for gays in this country, and 9/11 was a result of that.
Terry still lives in eastern North Carolina and now has a partner who is also gender nonconforming. Figures from UCLA's Williams Institute place Pitt County in the top half of the state for rate of same-sex couples, along with several other eastern counties, including Dare, New Hanover, Duplin, and Craven. The couple hasn't experienced much harassment, Terry says, since they are stealth and look like a heterosexual couple. But Terry says avoiding aggravation isn't always possible.
There have been acts of violence towards us that don't happen to other people. I mean, we've been called out on a drunk bus at ECU where we were harassed and told that we were freaks and that our sex life doesn't make sense and that we should be ashamed of ourselves. And I think the fact that we're stealth at all speaks volumes of what it's like to be part of the LGBT community in this part of the country.
The stigma surrounding the LGBTQ plus community, especially non-conforming individuals, led August Branch of Greenville to become an active advocate for the community. He is a volunteer for the Trans Lifeline. According to statistics from the Trans Lifeline, incoming calls from North Carolina have spiked since House Bill 2 passed on March 23rd. The new law has broad repercussions for everyone in the state, especially the estimated 250,000 members of the LGBTQ plus community, a Williams Institute approximation.
Custody of their children can become a battle because of it. Veterans also lose protection. People of color, race, religion, anything, no longer have the right to fight discrimination in the state.
Proponents of House Bill 2 and religious freedom laws debated and passed across the South and Midwest have said these laws underscore desire for personal liberty among those with more traditional values. Terry says personal liberty is exactly what members of the LGBTQ plus community are looking for, too.
We disagree with you, and we don't like a lot of the things that you believe in, and we're not telling you that you can't believe those things and that you can't live that way. So just to do us the same courtesy, like, you don't have to agree with us. You don't have to like it. You can condemn us to hell all of you want in your private spaces, but at the end of the day, we're all Americans, and America awards us the right, with multiple amendments on our Constitution, to live the way that we want to live authentically, and that doesn't affect you.
But they said things can be just as disheartening within the LGBTQ plus community. They said there's a lack of recognition from those within the community who are, quote, cisgendered, that is, those whose gender identity aligns with their given sex. Cis is derived from a term used in the field of chemistry, in which two atoms land on the same side of a molecule.
Oftentimes, when you go to gay parties, particularly in the South, there's space for white gay men, and you don't always feel included. Homonormativity is a huge problem in the LGBT movement in the United States that people don't like to talk about because they're like, well, gay marriage is legal, shouldn't you be happy? But there's a whole other group of people being persecuted.
Studies show gender and sexual nonconforming individuals make up the majority of the LGBTQ plus community, but are more prone to suicidal tendencies, unemployment, and homelessness. East Carolina University sociology professor Melinda Kane believes much of the neglect and hostility toward this segment of the community comes from the ambiguity and confusion associated with it.
Anytime that someone does not fit into those assumed to be clear-cut categories where physicality and social identities match, that can be very threatening to those who see those categories as very fixed and very real. And I think that's why you see the violence in particular for trans women.
Yet gender nonconforming individuals and those who fall between the gay and straight binary, also called polysexual in some circles, are, overall, having a tough time finding recognition within the LGBTQ+ community and by mainstream society. Dr. Kane said there's always been tension within the community since, like most communities, needs and goals of individuals don't always coincide.
Women, for example, early on were much more concerned about parental rights because they had children from previous heterosexual relationships, and custody was really key. Where for gay men, it might be other issues that we're focused on. So there are always some debates about who should speak for the movement, the goals that the movement should have, and those types of tensions continue today, especially around issues of bi individuals or as well as people who are trans.
The discussion on sexual orientation and gender identity is far from over in Eastern North Carolina or anywhere else. It's a matter far from the norm in the tobacco fields, fishing docks, and country churches that are still fixtures across the region. I'm Chris Thomas.
A new exhibit opened last week at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Southport, along the colonial Cape Fear, documents the history of southeastern North Carolina, from its vast supply of naval stores, shipping operations from the port in Wilmington, and rice cultivation in the 1700s. Exhibit designer Jamie Vassell says the permanent exhibit is filled with educational interactive displays.
We've got flip-up panels and smell stations, touchscreen, which is interactive for adults and kids, to really immerse you in an environment and really understand what people were doing in the colonial period.
Public Radio East collaborated with the North Carolina Maritime Museum for the project to help share the story of the Carolinas' rice production. When the industry was first established, what we know now as North and South Carolina was a single colony.
We are the northernmost region North Carolina for rice cultivation.
Lori Sanderlin is the curator of education for the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Southport.
It wasn't a very easy job to have or to have to process the rice in this area, but it was an important crop, especially Orton Plantation, right down the road from us, about 20 minutes, was one of the largest rice plantations that we have in the area.
During the late 1600s, rice plantations started to proliferate along the Lowcountry. Associate Professor of History at East Carolina University Karen Ziff says approximately 500 to 1,000 acres total were dedicated to rice cultivation in North Carolina. That's compared to 70,000 acres in South Carolina.
There are mainly two reasons why South Carolina was a more friendly, I guess, state towards growing rice. One of those reasons is because it had a longer growing season. It requires just more, you have to have a longer period before the frost. And so the rice that was grown there was generally a slightly better quality, at least for market consumption.
A booming sugarcane industry in Barbados also played into the Carolinas' rice growing interests. Sugarcane, which was produced on the Caribbean island, was so profitable for farmers that they didn't grow enough crops to feed their slaves. Farmers began to set up rice-growing operations on the South Carolina coast, and the rice was sent back to Barbados.
So what happens then is that in eastern North Carolina, you see some of the growing conditions favorable to rice growing, and some of these South Carolina planter families begin moving up to the Cape Fear region. They find that lower Cape Fear River region is very suitable to growing rice.
Around the mid-1700s, Orton Plantation and Kendall Plantation were established in Brunswick County, North Carolina, to grow rice.
Those two plantations were owned by a man named Roger Moore, and he had about 250 slaves on those two plantations. There were quite a number of rice plantations in the area. Most of them were nowhere near as big as the rice plantations in South Carolina.
Readying a rice field was backbreaking work, tasked mainly to slaves.
It's very difficult to do because you had these swampy areas with, you know, trees, some of them old growth trees that had to be cleared out. And of course, he brought in slaves to do this kind of really hard labor in terms of clearing land.
Before rice was planted, levees and dams had to be built so the cleared land could be flooded. At Orton Plantation and Kendall Plantation, fresh water from the Cape Fear River was manipulated to flow over the rice fields, submerging the plants for weeks at a time.
And then when the growing season needed to have more dry soil, they would dam up the river in order to allow the crops to continue to flourish.
Workers in the rice fields were exposed to dangerous and harsh conditions. They worked long days under the summer sun, trudging in swampy, snake and mosquito-infested water.
There was not any kind of mosquito control, so there was a lot of malaria in the area. It was not healthful work at all.
Zipf says planter families would give control to overseers and leave the plantation during the summer when malaria was more prevalent. Slaves from Africa already had experience growing rice, with male workers doing more hard labor and women working with the rice after the harvest.
They are the ones who are very instrumental in the techniques for separating the rice from the hull in order to make it consumable. And it requires a very deft hand in terms of utilizing what was a giant mortar and pestle in order to get these hulls off of the grain of rice without damaging the grain.
Even with the harshest conditions, expensive plantation maintenance, and human labor, rice cultivation was a lucrative business. Zipf says, though rice grown in southeastern North Carolina was mostly for local consumption, some of it was exported to the British Empire. During the early to mid-1700s, a new industry began to emerge in eastern North Carolina. Naval stores such as tar, pitch, and turpentine came from the numerous pine trees in the region and was used as waterproofing for ships. It was a more exciting and lucrative industry that would eventually replace rice production. Curator of Education for the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Southport, Lori Sanderlin, hopes visitors to the new Along the Colonial Cape Fear River exhibit gain a better understanding of the history of southeastern North Carolina and their contributions both geographically and economically.
People really don't quite grasp the importance of the longleaf pine, why we're called Tar Heels. We did process and send more naval stores than any other state and, of course, any other colony. But just the fact that they can come in and see that the trees made the masts and the sap, would, you know, you would cook it and make the tar, and all of these things tie directly into ships. And so it was very, very important for England to receive this product from the colonies, and North Carolina, of course, was the most abundant.
The exhibit is now on display at the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Southport Tuesday through Saturday from 9 to 5. For more information, go to ncmaritimemuseums.com. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Beaufort Lab is opening its doors to the public for an open house this Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. There will be family activities, informational tables, and guided tours of the lab facilities. This week, Mac McKee speaks with marine ecologist and communication specialist Jenny Vanderplume about the free event.
What types of research projects do you have going on right now at the NOAA Lab that folks will be able to learn about during this open house?
Well, when visitors come to see us on June 11th, they're going to learn all about harmful algal blooms, and the visitors themselves will be able to identify algae that cause harmful algal blooms, and we'll learn how we use this information to increase public health in the area, regionally and globally. Folks will also be exposed to the protected species work we do, looking at turtles, dolphins, and whales that frequent our waters, as well as how we track them through space and time. We will also be highlighting some other work we do with aquaculture and living shorelines.
And when touring the NOAA Lab, Jenny, what types of equipment and technology will the public be able to see in operation? in conjunction with those research projects?
Folks are going to learn a lot about how we sample fish populations. There are many research divers, like myself, that go on scuba to identify fish by species and size, and also assess habitat offshore here. We also use traps that have cameras on them to sample fish populations in deeper waters from North Carolina down to Florida. And at other times, we will deploy a remotely operated vehicle to sample fish populations that are difficult to access. So all those videos as well as equipment will be out for people to see. We're also going to be leading people through our aquaculture facilities. So they'll be able to see our flow-through systems and how we're working on red porgy and vermilion snapper as possible broodstock for offshore North Carolina marine aquaculture.
Now, I understand there'll be a lot of hands-on exhibits and that sort of thing. About like planting marsh grass, how do you do that in a controlled environment at the lab?
This is a great question. We have a living shoreline here at the lab that was begun in March 2000. It was implemented to test the effectiveness of using marsh cordgrass, Spartina alternifera, along with an oyster sill for erosion control in place of using a seawall or some other hardened shoreline. So since March of 2000, we have been restoring our eroded beach right on our own property. So we are used to taking groups to this specific living shoreline, particularly school groups, that will come and they plant plants along our restoration area. And so what we're going to do is with the visitors and families that come see us, they're going to take part in restoration.
And in conclusion, Jennifer, why is it important for coastal scientists to share their research with the public?
Well, I think it's extremely important for us to share the research going on in their very community because folks in the area are actually part of this work that we do, as well as the remarkable opportunities that are provided by our partners, the North Carolina Coastal Reserve and National Estuarine Research Reserve. They have many educational programs that they offer, and all of that is also on the island with us. So we just want to share all that is going on right within the Eastern North Carolina community, as well as highlight the National Weather Service. They will also be with us at this open house. So we just think it's important that the community understand all that's going on around them.
I've been speaking with Jenny Vanderplume of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Lab in Beaufort on Pirates Island. And of course, once again, that open house will be June the 11th. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, and I look forward to meeting you at our open house.
A new book highlights not the people and places that populate the Outer Banks, but the sometimes controversial conduit that brings them all together. George Olson has more.
In the ever-constant tug-of-war between development and environmental concerns on North Carolina's Outer Banks, both sides could almost certainly agree that no matter the state of things now, they're certainly better than one vision for the area around 1950.
NC Highway 12 has changed the face of the Outer Banks, influenced life there for residents, and made visitation possible in ways hardly dreamed of in years gone by. It has enriched the region and the state, eased the travel needs of locals, and brightened the lives of countless tourists. Equally important, the highway forestalled plans to turn the Outer Banks into a radioactive nuclear wasteland, and for that alone it deserves some respect.
Dawson Carr, reading from the tail end of his book, NC-12, Gateway to the Outer Banks, A History of the Road That Brought the Communities of the Outer Banks Together. His reference to radioactive nuclear wasteland isn't hyperbole about what progress has wrought. It's about the Outer Banks existing as an actual nuclear wasteland if government ideas for use of the barrier islands had come to fruition.
It showed that the military was interested in using the Outer Banks back in the late 40s and early 50s to replace the Marshall Islands as a test site for their nuclear weapons. They thought nobody lived there, and it was the perfect spot. It was away from land, and it would be perfect for blowing up their nuclear bombs. But when the director of the Atomic Energy Commission had pictures made, he started looking at those, and he saw that there was a road there. He didn't think there was anything there, and he saw a road, and that road had led to development of the area, and a whole lot of business had sprung up, and people had moved there, and he said, this is no place for atomic testing. So they had to move their testing site out to Nevada.
Dawson Carr talking about Project Nutmeg, which in 1948 rated the Outer Banks highly as a site for nuclear testing. Ultimately, the U.S. government opted elsewhere, the western United States, where they already owned the land that would become the Nevada testing site. But if not for Highway 12, which brought some ease of travel along the Outer Banks, the region could have been a much less inviting place. And if you try to trace the genesis of Highway 12, Carr suggests a precise date, December 17, 1903, the birth date of powered flight.
A few people came out there on weekends for dances and things like that, but very few people lived out there and very few came to visit. But once the Wright brothers made their flight, that was world famous. And the Outer Banks became world famous, and then everybody wanted to come. The trouble was they couldn't get there. There were no bridges, and there were no roads on the islands once they got there. So that had to be countered before the Outer Banks could become anything. But it was truly the Wright brothers' flight that served as a catalyst for the road and for the development of the Outer Banks.
Not that the Wrights flew on December 17, 1903, and payments started being laid the following morning. Initial roads were roads only in the strictest sense. They started somewhere and ended another. Carr's book, NC-12, Gateway to the Outer Banks, features a photo just inside the cover of a car traversing one of these roads, sand that had developed ruts from drivers that were augmented to ease travel, leaving what almost looks like a railway for automobiles.
They had to travel between roads, and a few people on the Outer Banks actually bought cars. And although they were hard to use out there with all the sand, they had to travel between towns, and they made ruts in the sand, which tended to be somewhat permanent after a while, but there were still ruts in the sand. So to help cars pass and travel, they put boards in the rut and made a kind of a boarded road, and the people could ride on those.
While the initial roads share little in what today's roads look like, the promise of Highway 12 then was pretty much the same as now, a conduit to keep area economies chugging along. And this notion crystallized around 1925 as area leaders began to face a problem that remains true today, a decline in the fisheries industry.
And the oyster beds had been over-harvested, and things were just going downhill. And so the Dare County Commissioner said, we've got to do something to save the economy of the Outer Banks. And what they decided to do was put a bridge between Roanoke Island and Nag's Head. And they went to the state and asked the state to help. And North Carolina just didn't have that much interest in the Outer Banks at the time, like a lot of other people. And they declined the chance to put a bridge. And so the Outer Bankers, being what they are, they said, well, we'll just do it ourselves. And they did. They passed a bond issue for $300,000. And they built a two-mile bridge that led from Roanoke Island over to Nag's Head, and that changed the future of the Outer Banks forever.
State government also had no interest when a few years later in 1930, a bridge from the Elizabeth City area to Kitty Hawk was constructed, a privately paid-for toll bridge. But eventually the state got involved. Dawson Carr speculates a little embarrassment went a long way in that decision, as first local government and then local businesses successfully completed what the state had deemed an unnecessary expenditure to connect sparsely populated areas.
They were toll bridges, and so many cars were crossing them. The people in North Carolina government saw that and said, hey, you know, maybe we needed to build those bridges there after all. So they bought the two bridges from the private enterprises and took them over. And, in fact, eliminated the tolls, which was a good thing. And then people could come to the Outer Banks free. And after they bought the two bridges, or actually before they bought them, they decided to pave a roadway between the ends of the two bridges, which was through the Nag's Head Kitty Hawk area. And that area evolved very quickly.
In fits and starts, soon the Outer Banks was connected, with Highway 12 stretching from Corolla in the north to Ocracoke Island at the south. And nature has intervened many times over the lifetime of the highway. New Inlet has opened and closed many times in recorded history, and the fact there's a road there now that wasn't in the 1700s didn't dissuade the inlet north of Rodanthe from reopening when Hurricane Irene struck in 2011. The road, once ignored by the state, now continuously gets rebuilt by the state when these types of events occur, something which irks those who, as Dawson Carr writes, believe that the highway and its maintenance interfere with the natural processes that have nourished and restored the Barrier Island chain throughout its existence. That argument will probably continue, even with an agreement that has been reached to replace the Bonner Bridge in a manner to provide some protection to the Outer Banks Pea Island Refuge. Dawson Carr sees the sight of the highway's detractors, but ultimately believes it serves a valuable purpose.
I don't know if it's progress or not, but I like the fact that the road is there because people can come and see all the beauty of the Outer Banks and visit those historic sites and the wilderness areas that are there. And to me, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and if no one is there to behold it, there's no beauty. So I can't see just maintaining the Outer Banks if nobody has access to them. So my opinion is that the highway should be there and has served a good purpose. Of course, I don't live out there, so that's an external opinion.
Dawson Carr taught for 27 years at Sandhills Community College in Moore County. He is the author of NC-12, Gateway to the Outer Banks, which is published by the University of North Carolina Press. I'm George Olson.
Thanks for listening to the Downeast Journal. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, drop us a line at publicradioeast.org.